For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Today, recorded live at the Wigtown Book Festival. And on today's show, Robin Ince, Adam Andrusier, Graham McCrae Burnett, Stuart Kelly and Paula Hawkins. Unfortunately, Red Sail couldn't join me at this year's Wigtown Book Festival, so it's a solo effort from me, Robert Kirkwood. For obvious reasons, this year's festival was the first live one in 2 years and a bit smaller than previous festivals. It was also a hybrid festival with events online, events live, and live events streamed online, more of which later on in today's show. And I should add that I spoke to more people at Wigtown than we can fit into this hour. So listen out for interviews on the Museum Makers, the Library, A Fragile History, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, and more in future editions of Read On. But coming up today, the author of The Girl on the Train, Paula Hawkins, tells me about her new book, A Slow Fire Burning. Literary editor of The Scotsman, Stuart Kelly, tells me about the books of his life. Comedian and star of The Infinite Monkey Cage, Robin Ince, tells Lee Randall about the importance of being interested, adventures in scientific curiosity. And we learn about the world of autograph hunting from Adam Andrusier and his book, Two Hitlers and a Marilyn. That's all coming up on today's Wigtown Book Festival Read On Special. Graham McCrae Burnett is no stranger to the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow. His first novel, The Disappearance of Adele Badeau, was recorded there, narrated by James Bryce, as was his second novel, the Booker shortlisted, His Bloody Project. That book tells the story of a brutal triple murder in the remote Scottish Highlands in 1869, using witness statements, a memoir written by the accused, and a documentary account of the trial, leaving many readers to speculate on what was true and what wasn't. Graham was at the Wigtown Book Festival with his fourth novel, Case Study, a thrilling investigation into the nature of sanity and identity, which is equally intriguing. It features a series of notebooks apparently sent to the author in 2020 to aid his research into psychotherapist Arthur Collins Braithwaite, a contemporary of R.D. Lang. The five notebooks comprise the novel, interspersed with the author's own biographical material on Braithwaite, and readers once again need to come to their own conclusions about the truth of the situation. The print version is published by our old friends at Saraband Books, and the audio version is produced by Belinda Publishing.
Case Study, written by Graham McCrae Burnett and read by Serena Mantigi and Graham Rooney.
I have decided to write down everything that happens because I feel, I suppose, I may be putting myself in danger. And, if proved to be right, a rare occurrence admittedly, this notebook might serve as some kind of evidence. Regrettably, as will become clear, I have little talent for composition. As I read over my previous sentence, I do rather cringe. But if I dilly-dally over style, I fear I will never get anywhere. Miss Lyle, my English mistress, used to chide me for trying to cram too many thoughts into a single sentence. This, she said, was a sign of a disorderly mind. You must first decide what it is you wish to say, then express it in the plainest terms. That was her mantra, and though it is doubtless a good one, I can see that I have already failed. I have said that I may be putting myself in danger, but there I go, off on an irrelevant digression. Rather than beginning again, however, I shall press on. What matters here is substance rather than style, that these pages constitute a record of what is to occur. It may be that were my narrative too polished, it might lack credibility, that somehow the ring of truth lies in infelicity. In any case, I cannot follow Miss Lyle's advice, as I do not yet know what it is I wish to say. However, for the sake of anyone unfortunate enough to find themselves reading this, I will endeavour to be clear, to express myself in the plainest terms.
Hi, Robert. Well, the new book is called Case Study. It's set in London in 1965, and it tells the story of a young woman who believes that a radical psychotherapist called Collins Braithwaite has driven her sister Veronica to suicide. So she does what any normal person would do under the circumstances and presents herself to Collins Braithwaite as a client under the assumed name of Rebecca Smith. And that is the kind of premise of the story, and that's how everything begins.
The material was haphazardly arranged, but that only added, I thought, to the authenticity of what she had to say. Within a few days, however, I had convinced myself that I was the victim of a prank. What could be more calculated to entice me than a set of found notebooks alleging criminal malpractice by a person I happened to be researching? If it was a hoax, however, Mr. Gray had gone to a great deal of trouble, not least of which was the writing of the documents themselves. I decided to carry out a few checks.
Don't really draw comparisons to earlier work, but it is, again, found documents or notebooks given to the author.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I was sent the notebooks written by this young female character. There's a comparison to be made with the way the structure of His Bloody Project, in that it's made up of different documents. There's also the other material in Case Study is my biography, really, of Collins Braithwaite, who's very much a larger-than-life charismatic figure at the kind of the centre of London's counterculture.
There's a deeper question here, because you said you were sent the notebooks, but you wrote them. Are you the Rebecca in this story? Are you pretending to be someone else?
That's a very good question, a very deep question. Am I pretending to be somebody else? Well, that assumes that I know who I am in the first place. Maybe we're not sure what the pretense is and what the reality is. And to some extent, you know, that's something that runs through this book. I mean, all the characters kind of have dual personas, which wasn't a deliberate thing. And, you know, a book that's mentioned within the book is R.D. Lang's classic book on psychology, The Divided Self, which is very much about the personas we present to the world, or that some people do. So am I pretending to be somebody else? I'm not sure.
It's too deep for Saturday morning, isn't it?
It's always time for R.D. Lang.
It's the first book you've written from a female perspective. How was it finding that voice?
The voice came to me immediately. As soon as I wrote the opening sentence, I knew this character. The voice that she uses and the language that she uses. I mean, I did a fair bit of research. I enjoy research. And research is often like forming the vocabulary that I feel the character will use. I read a lot of 1960s women's magazines, for example, and picked up the vocabulary. But I knew this character, you know, just as soon as I started writing, which is quite unusual.
You've mentioned before that your workplace was the Mitchell Library. How was it during lockdown when your workplace was shut?
Yeah, they closed my office, you know. I mean, I think of the Mitchell, it's just my personal office. You're very lucky as a writer because you can still work, and you, of course, can work at home. You don't need too much equipment. So my routine was a bit disturbed, and I go to the Mitchell because there's less distractions there, and when I'm at home, I tend to procrastinate even more and clean the cooker and all that stuff. But I think as writers, as I say, we're very fortunate that we can continue working and people are still reading books, and perhaps even more so during the lockdowns. So, you know, I mean, of course, I wasn't able to travel and do things like be in Wigton, but, you know, I've survived okay.
In this spirit, I shall begin by stating the facts. The danger to which I have alluded comes in the person of Collins Braithwaite. You will have heard him described in the press as Britain's most dangerous man. This on account of his ideas about psychiatry. It is my belief, however, that it is not merely his ideas that are dangerous. I am convinced, you see, that Dr. Braithwaite killed my sister Veronica.
The audio version's narrated by both a male and a female narrator. Did you have any choice in who read it?
I was lucky enough to be sent some sample readings for both parts of the book, and I was absolutely there was a real clear winner with both the choices. I'm totally delighted with the voices the characters have found. You know, they sound like how they should have sounded in my head, which is what you want as the author when you're listening to an audiobook.
I do not mean that he murdered her in the normal sense of the word, but that he is, nonetheless, as responsible for her death as if he had strangled her with his bare hands. 2 years ago, Veronica threw herself from the overpass at Bridge Approach in Camden and was killed by the 4:45 to High Barnet. You could hardly imagine a person less likely to commit such an act. She was 26 years old, intelligent, successful, and passably attractive. Regardless of this, she had, unbeknown to my father and me, been consulting Dr. Braithwaite for some weeks. This I know from his own account.
Case Study by Graham McCree Burnett is available wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. And Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Always good to talk to you.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival. And as I said at the top of the show, this was a hybrid festival with many live events streamed online. So with the permission of everyone involved, here's Lee Randall in conversation with Robin Ince about his book, The Importance of Being Interested.
The book starts with the premise that you went from being a young boy who was intrigued by and loved science to believing that it wasn't for you. And some of that blame lies with the people who taught you, who just didn't make it inspiring, etc. So I wanted to ask you two things, sort of what was wrong with the science education you received? And I know you have a son, and I'm wondering, have you noticed any change in how he's being taught science?
Well, I think the battle is, in one way, it hasn't improved. But this is not, I should make this very clear, it's very often not about the teachers, it's about the curriculum.
Oh, no,
and I realise that also, because, you know, I'm talking particularly about the England and Wales curriculum as well, which I should be specific about, but it is... Even someone like Carlo Rovelli, who, you know, is a brilliant scientist and a brilliant writer on science, when I talked to him, he was going, oh, God, he said it was really hard to get through all those years of talking about levers and pulleys. And you have this incredible universe, and you have... I mean, I remember one of the things that got me back into being interested in science was when I think it was an article in The Independent many, many years ago about the fact the echoes of the Big Bang were still moving around the universe. Mm-hmm. And compared to burning a peanut under a test tube to find out the energy that was inside a peanut, the echoes of the Big Bang were kind of a little bit more exciting. And I like peanuts, you know, it's nothing against them. And I think this is a problem that we still face. And certainly some of the teachers that I spoke to said, it's just about memorizing more and more equations. And of course, knowing an equation, the order of the letters and the numbers, does not mean that you know the equation. Mm-hmm. And I think also there's been a problem for a long time, which is that science is, of all of the subjects in the curriculum, it is taught in a way that says, we're teaching this for the people who are going to become scientists. In a way that English or history is not taught in a way that that's for people who will be historians or will be novelists or whatever they might be. And so I think there is almost, it seems deliberate, there's a sense that they want to alienate out as many people as possible. Because and this bit, which is to lose, I mean, what I think particularly gets lost in a lot of the ways that science is taught is the excitement and the play.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I see this with... Having worked with scientists now for over 15 years and with Brian very closely, people still think of scientists as this kind of, hello, I'm a scientist, I've just counted a thing, and I've come up with a summary of it in this equation, which is useful. Thank you, scientist. Do you do anything else in life? No, I count. And it's kind of this... And, of course, the scientists I know... I mean, a good example is we're doing the Cheltenham Science Festival. The Cheltenham Science Festival kind of said, hey, can we get the same rate on rooms that we get for the jazz festival? And this hotel said, no, you can't, because jazz people really drink, and I don't think we'll see that at the science festival. Yeah, they learnt a lesson there, I can tell you. And, you know, and everyone at Cheltenham Science Festival, at loads of the science festival, it's very different, in fact, for the literary festival, where people can be very distant. Everyone's going, oh, I've read that bit of research. Oh, my God, have you heard this incredible idea? What if neutrinos do go faster than the speed of light? Yeah, I've been thinking about that as well. It's filled with excitement and play.
Can I add another word? I get very angry with people who don't understand how creative science is. Like, if you decide, I want to find out how this thing gets to be that thing, you have to invent an experiment that may or may not prove what you're hoping. I mean, so I think the other word I would love to add to your is creativity.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's fascinating that, you know, Jacob Bronowski, who made the brilliant The Ascent of Man and wonderful essayist as well on science, and he spent so much of his career talking about imagination. You know, his first book, as far as I remember, was about William Blake. And then he was a mathematician, but he knew that this was the most important thing. And I'm fascinated in the divide between what we consider to be scientific imagination and artistic imagination.
Okay.
Because I obviously in the end result there is a difference. But in its aspirations, mm-hmm. I don't think there is nearly as much of a difference as we imagine. Because when we see beautiful art that is transcendent, mm-hmm. then it is giving us some kind of sense of the existence. You know, it's giving us hope. It's giving us a coping mechanism. It's giving us... And in the same way, when I look at... I mean, I talk about it in the book, the fact that I had this argument with Brian Eno. I know, there's a name drop. Anyway, but it was about the fact that when I look at, for instance, Earthrise, that incredible picture taken by Apollo 8, mm-hmm. the sensation I get from that is not that different from when I look at something beautiful painted like a dusk painted by Turner. Mm. Both of them, the initial reaction is to be incredibly moved. I don't go, oh, that's fascinating, because I know exactly what kind of propellant was used to get Apollo 8 there. I'm going, wow, there is a species that has managed to leave its own planet. Okay, it's not gone very far, and it's looking back on where everyone lives. And when I look at Turner's sunsets, maybe Petworth House, some of the ones that he did around there, mm-hmm. I think, wow, someone, hydrogen has turned to helium. It has created photons of light. Light has then, you know, passed through to planet Earth. It's hit the surface just outside Petworth House. It's now, some of it's been reflected into the eyes of J.M.W. Turner, and he has gone, okay, I'm now going to create this. Both of those things, whether it's propelling people into space or whether it's J.M.W. Turner, then the light going into his eyes and him creating that beauty, both of them to me are things with real transcendence to them.
Mm-hmm.
This ginger beer I had earlier has really kicked in, by the way. I had some very good ginger beer.
I think he's on a sugar rush. But the thing is, he's like this all the time. That's the beauty of it. Another thing you ask yourself in the book is, am I allowed to think about these things because I have no qualifications in this subject matter? And that's something that we all... And your answer was, damn straight I'm allowed to think about these things. Can you amplify that idea?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems we have as a species is a fear of shame. A fear of shame which shuts down so many conversations. You know, and I know... When I talk with Brian and when we sometimes do Q&As, the number of times that a question sent to us will start with, I know this probably sounds like a stupid question. And the same thing, every Sunday when I do with the show with Helen Chersky, people say, I hope this isn't too silly. And they're never silly, because they come from a genuine place of interest. And the most simple question is never a simple question, because you only have to unwrap a bit of it and it turns out there's an enormous number of the secrets of the universe are somewhere inside each one of these, what might appear to be very parochial and small experiences. So I think that's a lot of the battle, is not to feel... I mean, I think I finally got over that. That's why I call myself a professional idiot and a keen amateur as well, which is, you know, my job is very often to go up to Brian or whoever I'm working with and ask the question that I think lots of other people are thinking, but are thinking, am I going to look silly if I ask this? And it's taken me years to go, just ask the question if it's in your head. And if someone laughs at you, do you know what? They're the villain there, because mockery is so easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is if someone has interest. And I think we see this throughout our school life and beyond. That bit, I'm sure many of us may well have had those kind of teachers that would get an easy laugh because they could mock you for what they consider to be the dumb question.
Yes.
And that's why we have to be as open as possible.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is about shame. And I think people do. Science is very complex, and you get this thing where people imagine if they pick up a book, they read a book about quantum theory, and they go, I still don't understand it, and I've read a book on it. And then you introduce them to someone who's been studying it for 50 years, and you go, they don't understand it either. I mean, they don't understand it to a higher level of not understanding than you don't understand it, but it takes Don't worry if you read a book and you don't immediately understand everything. You probably won't. But with luck, you've picked up just these little things, which mean the sky looks different today. Yeah. That animal looks different today. Yeah. All of it. And so I think that's part of it, is an important thing, which is not to worry about the idea that you're not going to become Mr. Know-it-all by the end of it. But you're going to go, oh, I've just a little bit's changed today.
Let's talk about the idea of reality. I have a few questions about it. I suspect I'll only need one of them.
I'm sorry, by the way. I do realize that I do this every time, that Lee asked me a question, and then whatever answer is the final part, if you rewound this, you'd go, well, that had nothing to do with it. That was...
That is the absolute beauty of it. Now, I'm not coordinated enough to be able to actually surf on waves, but I can surf on stage here with you. So just carry on. I love it this way. One of the things you say in the book is science is the search for an objective reality by a creature with a subjective view of the world. And then you talk about a physicist called Brian Greene, who believes that there is an ultimate reality. Mm. So let's unpack some of that.
Well, the ultimate reality, though, is not the reality that we experience. So the reality that we are experiencing now is a subjective reality. And again, in terms of doubt, that's a very, very important thing. You see so many people in the news media, in social media, who are utterly certain they've seen something and this is the truth.
Oh, yeah.
And once you start seeing the different tests that are done, and you realize that every single one of us is painting a slightly different picture.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one of us who's fallen out with a friend because they are certain that something meant this, or that person said that, or that. So that loosening up is, I think, very important. The ultimate reality that Brian Greene talks about is that once you get down to a quantum level, and we won't be going to, you know, I mean, there's a beautiful thing. Niels Bohr talked about the fact that the incredible thing about reality is that it was ultimately made of things that aren't actually real. That
when my head you get just exploded.
Yeah, it makes my head explode every time that I think about that. And Niels Bohr, who had lots of lovely things about, I mean, he used to love cowboy movies. And so he would be working on these incredible equations about quantum mechanics. And then he'd say to his students, let's go and see a Randolph Scott double bill. And they'd go, he'd be so embarrassing as well, because he was almost sitting there doing this kind of thing. And then he'd go back to the double slit experiment. And he had, you know, he had a lucky horseshoe in his lab. And someone said to him once, Niels, surely you don't believe in that. He said, no, I don't believe in it, but apparently it works whether you believe in it or not, which I think is a beautiful little bit of kind of... and he, you know, again, a really interesting character. But I think that bit, so that is right down at a level which we are almost incapable of observing. You know, we've begun to get that level of technology that allows it, but right down at a deep level, there is an underlying reality. But you, at this level, you need to be questioning all of your experiences, if you're going to argue about them, etc. At this level, it goes. I don't think it is possible to be ultimately objective. I mean, the biggest argument that I ever had with Brian Cox, we don't argue very much. I mean, I was talking to a neuroscientist who said the thing that we have to remember as human beings is that we cannot observe nature from outside of nature. Because we are part of nature as well. We are not able to step out of being another creature which has evolved, which has much of the same chemistry as well as things. I mean, one of my favourite things, Paul Nurse, who is a wonderful Nobel Prize winner, and he would do lectures sometimes to people who are a bit resistant on ideas of the fact that we are connected to all other living creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And if he was in the Midwest of America, someone might stand up and say, are you saying that we're related to apes? And he would say, much better than that, we're related to yeast. And And his work was in yeast as well. This is the great thing, is, you know, the work that he basically found that the cellular division, that the apparatus, the technology, if you want to call it that, of it, is also something that is in all living things. And that was by him going back to the bin as well. That's what I love about these stories. There's so many different stories about it. One, the reason he won the Nobel Prize was because he was bad at French. Right. What happened was, and I never knew this, that if you were, I think this is about 40 years ago, to get into university, you needed to have one modern language. Mm-hmm. And he tried to pass French O-level, I think, 7 times. and failed so he couldn't go to university. Mm-hmm. So he went to work in a brewery, which is where he started to get to know yeast. And so that, and that's that beautiful thing, you know, the kind of Wittgenstein thing about, you know, if nobody ever did stupid things, then nothing intelligent would get done. You know, this thing that he was unable to do is what led him to that place. And then even the beginning of the work that led to him winning the Nobel Prize was, but he was working in the lab and he'd done all these samples and they just chucked him in the bin and left. And then he had his tea and then he went, oh, do you know what? I think maybe there was something back in that bin, and he went back to the bin and he rifled through the bin and he took out what was the beginning really of the story that would lead to him. So there's lots of lessons there. One, fail, and two, spend a lot more time looking in your bin.
Thanks to Lee Randall and to Robin Innes. The Importance of Being Interested is available in Audio Now, read by the author.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
Paula Hawkins worked as a journalist for 15 years before turning her hand to fiction. Her first thriller under her own name, The Girl on the Train, has been a global phenomenon, selling 23 million copies worldwide and published in over 40 languages. It was the number one bestseller around the world and was a number one box office hit film starring Emily Blunt. Paula was at the Wigtown Book Festival with her third novel, A Slow Fire Burning, which is read by Rosamund Pike.
Her shower offered a choice of very hot or very cold, nothing in between. She ran the tips of her wrinkled fingers back and forth over her bone-white, beautiful scars, hip, thigh, shoulder, back of skull. Here I am, she said quietly to herself. Here I am.
It's a novel about revenge. It opens with a young man's body is found on a houseboat on the Regent's Canal. He's been brutally murdered, and there are three women who are connected to him, very intriguing characters who may or may not be involved in the killing.
Afterwards, her forearm wrapped ineffectually in reams of toilet paper, the rest of her wrapped in a threadbare towel, sitting on the ugly grey pleather sofa in her living room, Laura rang her mother. It went to voicemail, and she hung up. No point wasting credit. She rang her father next. You all right, chicken? She could hear noises in the background. The radio. Five Live. Dad! She felt a lump rise to her throat, and she swallowed it. What's up? Dad, could you come round? I had a bad night. I was wondering if you could just come over for a bit. I know it's a bit of a drive, but I... No, Philip. Deirdre in the background, hissing through clenched teeth. We've got bridge. Dad, could you take me off speaker? Sweetheart, I... Seriously, could you take me off speaker? I don't want to hear her voice. It makes me want to set fire to things. Now, come on, Laura. Just forget it, Dad. It doesn't matter.
Now, what came first? Was it the plot or the character?
My novels always start with character. So I started with one particular character, Laura, who's a young woman who's had a very difficult start in her life. She had an accident as a child and she sort of struggles with various issues, loss of temper, she has no filter, she says inappropriate things. It's difficult for her to navigate the world. So I started with this character. She's, as I say, she's problematic, but she's also vulnerable and I think she's quite appealing too. So I started with her and then I also had a location, which was the Regent's Canal in London, and the houseboats there, which provided me with some inspiration, and that setting and the character were the starting points for the book.
On her way to the bedroom, she stepped on her jacket, which she dropped in the hallway in her rush to get to the bathroom. She bent down and picked it up. The sleeve was torn, Daniel's watch still in the pocket. She took the watch out, turned it over, slipped it onto her wrist. The toilet paper around her forearm bloomed scarlet, her limb throbbing gently as the blood pulsed out of her. Her head swam.
Rosamund Pike does the audio version of this book. Did you have any choice in narrator?
I was given a list, and I wasn't the person who drew up the list, but I was ecstatic when Rosamund said yes. I think she was pretty much top of that list. You know, I knew she has an extraordinary range. I've seen her do sort of anything from Austin to Gone Girl, where she plays a psychopath. So she's perfect in a way for this book because of that range. And you've got these basically five very different characters that she's got to inhabit, which she does wonderfully. So, yeah, I was absolutely thrilled that she agreed to do it.
Now, one thing we don't get if we download the book from the RNIB Talking Books Library is the cover. Tell us a little bit about that.
Ah, yes. So the cover is we've got a slow fire burning and we've got some what looks like smoke, but in that smoke you can see a number of faces. And what's really interesting about that is not everybody seems to sees the same face first. So, and that fits very well with the novel, which you will understand when you've read it, that sort of different faces emerge from the smoke and different people come to prominence at different times.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do. I love the experience of listening to audiobooks. It really takes you back to childhood, that thing of having somebody tell you a story. And, you know, when it's a well-read one, it's just an absolutely, a transporting experience. I do love an audiobook.
Using a pair of scissors to scrape beneath her fingernails, she watched the water running rosy at her feet. She closed her eyes. She listened to Daniel's voice asking, "What is wrong with you?" And Deirdre's voice saying, "No, Philip, we've got bridge." And to her own, "Set fire to things. Set fire, set fire, set fire, set fire."
A Slow Fire Burning is available in audio commercially now and on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library, where you can also find Paula's second book, Into the Water, and of course, The Girl on the Train. You're listening to a Read On Wigtown Book Festival special. Next up, Adam Androsia spent his childhood in pursuit of autographs. After writing to every famous person he could think of, he soon jostled with paparazzi at stage doors, coming face to face with the most famous people on the planet. This was a backstage pass to a world beyond his chaotic family home in Pinner and his Holocaust-obsessed father, who was always taking photographs and collected postcards of synagogues destroyed by the Nazis. Adam was in conversation with Lee Randall, but first he read from his book, Two Hitlers and a Marilyn.
My father had a penchant for a particular money shot. My mother, my sister and me in a dreary line. "Come on," he'd call out to us. "Look happy. We're trying. It's not easy." We bared our teeth in front of triptychs, on gondolas in Venice, beside welcome to wherever signs. "You're a fantasist," argued Mum. "No one's going to look at all these photos." "I'll look at them. I want to have a record." In fact, what Dad mostly looked at was his collection of postcards of synagogues destroyed by the Nazis. Over bowls of Frosties, my sister, Ruth, and I got minute-by-minute accounts of Kristallnacht, drawn from our father's vast library of books on Hitler, the Third Reich, and genocide. Our games of Twister were interrupted by the death toll at Treblinka. At weekends, Dad went to his study to take photographs of his synagogue postcards using a special mounted camera above the desk. The camera was a gift to himself for his 40th birthday. He invited friends up there to watch him work. "Very good, Adrian," you heard them say. "Nice to have a hobby." I asked Dad why he collected synagogues when we hardly ever went to Pinner United Synagogue. "Because of continuity," he said flatly. "These buildings were destroyed by Hitler. The ones that survived are now libraries and sports centres and cinemas. It's important to have a record." "Again with the Nazis," my mother called out from the kitchen. "He's 10 years old. Can you knock it off?" One day, Dad decided to go through a box of his overflow family photos and cut out our faces with scissors. He found famous images in books, superimposed our faces, then took new pictures with his special camera. For example, a shot of Rudolf Nureyev dancing with Margot Fontaine got Mum and Dad's faces superimposed. Or Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers became me and my sister. Or the sailor kissing the girl in Times Square at the end of World War II turned into Dad's accountant and his wife. We passed the study and heard the camera clicking and Dad laughing to himself as if he was the funniest man in the world. He got the images developed near his office and came home with a pile of 8x10-inch shiny prints that he peeled away one by one like a magician. "It's perverse," said Mum, turning to me, the 10-year-old, for an explanation. "Why would anyone do this?" "Oh, it's just a bit of fun," said Dad. "How about this one?" My sister and I, as US Marines, raising the stars and stripes at Iwo Jima. "And this," my father's business partner, Michael Rose, delivering a speech at Nuremberg. "And this is the one I'll use next." Dad flashed his prized possession at us, a hand-autographed photo of Danny Kaye, in character as Hans Christian Andersen, bought at one of his postcard fairs. "Sincerely yours, Danny Kaye," it said in fountain pen ink. My father adored Danny Kaye and loved putting us in front of his films. Kaye was forever in excruciating situations like having to perform impromptu ballets on stage or pretending he was Irish or having to climb through people's cars to get across a street. He did silly voices and embarrassed people, just like Dad. I liked Danny Kaye, but also pitied him because he was always such a first-class schmuck. "I plan to use this on top." Dad moved his own cut-out face, sporting a false Hasidic beard, into position over Danny Kaye's. "I think you need help," said Mum.
Let's talk a little bit about the autographs. I'm really, really intrigued. Beginning to collect autographs worked in two ways for you, because there is a great... On the one hand, it was a connection to your father, because he collected things. So I'd like to get you to talk about that. But on the other hand, you say this really interesting thing. You say that after you got Ronnie Barker's autograph, that night when he was on the television, you felt like he belonged to you now. Mm-hmm. He wasn't theirs. He belonged to you. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about both those things, both about the link to your dad and about the sort of direct link then to this other world?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I grew up around, in particular, my dad's fandom for certain people. I mean, I mentioned Danny Kaye in there, but others, you know, Charlie Chaplin and various people, and he'd get us to watch these films, and he's very, very keen for us to appreciate the things that he appreciated. Mm-hmm. And these, particularly Danny Kaye, that really sticks in my mind, because he did remind me of my dad and these funny sketches and things that he'd do. And it felt a bit like watching a version of my dad or something else. And yeah, I mean, I guess there's some sense in which maybe as immigrants, Jewish people or immigrants generally kind of look towards the culture in a slightly different way. They feel slightly outside of it. And so they cling to these famous people that are definitely, they identify as being a part of the culture. And then that makes them feel more connected or something. But I think I also felt that I was slightly surpassing my dad in choosing to collect in that area. So he was collecting, we know what he was collecting. And so for me to collect what I was collecting was just vastly different. These were people who were alive, at least initially. And they were people who'd done things and people who were talented. And I suppose, well, my dad and me too, there was a feeling of... what's the word? Being connected with great talent or something. Like that thing of, you say, like, I felt like Ronnie Barker was mine, some feeling of wanting to achieve greatness. I mean, my dad used to say, actually in connection with the whether or not there was a God, he would say, the question is, will you leave your mark? The question is, what will you do in your lifetime? How will you leave your mark? And I think that that is somehow connected with it too, this feeling that the famous people are doing something that is going to last beyond their death. And so there's almost like a religious level to it too, that they're like these icons who seem to have some magic religious dust to them.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. What did it feel like? Can you describe the chase? Because I know with my obsession with possession, sometimes it's the actual act of acquisition that's almost more exciting than the possession.
It's funny, because there were different sides to that, because initially when I started, I didn't know who the people were. I knew who Ronnie Barker was, but most of the people that I wrote to, because I'd start off by writing letters, I didn't know them. My parents would say, why don't you write to Bonnie Langford? Or, you know, I didn't know who these people were. But there was this feeling of... The famous people were my parents' famous people. So I think initially I was getting in touch with them and doing something almost on my parents' behalf. And then there was the level of physically going to stage doors and meeting the actual people who I either knew or didn't know. But then there's that human connection and that strange dissonance between thinking this person is superhuman, and yet here they are. They seem to be actually human, and they're right in front of me, and what can I get from them? What mark can they leave for me? I'd be at school playing cricket or something, and I'd think, I wonder what's arrived in the post, and there'd be a little envelope from Calcutta and a letter from Mother Teresa. I mean, it was really exciting, and I didn't know who I'd hear from. Mm-hmm. And I suppose with each autograph that arrived, that gave me a subtly different sense of who I was. It was almost like slightly changing the fibre of my being. If I'm someone that Mother Teresa's in touch with, or, you know...
I've got on speed dial.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Can you talk... There's another character in the book, a guy called Sig Bernstein, who I found, you know, he's such an eccentric... he crops up periodically in the story, both when you're a child and then when you're much older. Can you tell the audience who he was and how he wove into your life?
Yeah, Sig Bernstein, there was a guy who had a stall at a postcard fair. He was an American guy, but he lived in London all his adult life. A real sort of gangster type. And he sold autographs, and it was autographs of dead people. It was mostly Hollywood celebrities. And he was the first person who I ever saw offering dead people's autographs. And he also, as a youth, had worked in the film studios, and he had actually been employed to sign photographs on behalf of some of the big stars. So he would talk about that a lot, and he had a lot of great stories about, you know, Frank Sinatra throwing boiling water out of his window. And so he had all sorts of really interesting celebrity tales. Mm-hmm. And also this curious thing about how that he had essentially been a forger in the studios. And he was an expert. And he was also, he was always rubbishing all the other dealers and rubbishing everyone, you know, really narcissistic character. So yeah, I met him as a teenager. And then when I ended up becoming a dealer, you know, he was someone that I would bump into from time to time. And he was always pretty unpleasant, but sort of compelling as well.
Yeah, he's very compelling.
Yeah, he told good stories. And in fact, in later years, I guess I'm talking about 10, 15 years ago, I used to go down and visit him. He had a stall at some far reaches of London. I mean, really deep south of London. A stall at some really odd little crummy fair next to a massive Tesco's. And I'd go once a week, and he would sort of lure me there and say, you know, next week I'm going to bring, and it'll be some incredibly rare thing. And he never did, you know. He'd bring something the next week, some little thing. But basically, he was sort of luring me there for chats. Mm-hmm. And they were interesting chats, but it did get increasingly frustrating because the autographs were getting worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, and in the end, I had to knock it on the head, but yeah.
He was one of the first people to sort of say, you know, real, not real, real.
Yeah, yeah. He looked through my album. He's like, Laurence Olivier's daughter signed that. You know, he knew everything. And he'd just rubbished 90% of my collection as being fake.
But also educated you.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did, definitely.
I'm intrigued by the parallel in the story between discovering that, in fact, some of your autographs were not worth the papers they were printed on.
Yeah.
And also discovering that your father wasn't necessarily the person you hoped he would be or thought he would be. The memoir does strike me, the poignant part strikes me as it felt like a succession of disillusionments.
Mm-hmm.
That you were unveiling, you were saying, you know, this is all very funny and eccentric, but then this, then I had to reckon with this, and then I had to reckon with this. Can I get you to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of growing up probably is like that, layers of disillusionment, yeah. Until you find your own kind of path, but or maybe it just carries on being layers of disillusionment. But I think that if I hadn't reached that point where I'd realised that a lot of these autographs are fake, I wonder, would I have lost interest or would I have kept going? Because there was something about that, apart from, I mean, it was initially incredibly gutting and disappointing, mm-hmm. but then there was the challenge, well, how do I get the real ones? How do I make, you know, how do I make Frank Sinatra send me actually sign something in the mail to me rather than one of his secretaries? So it was this great challenge, but it was also this, maybe this is overlaid now as an adult and as a writer, but this interest in, well, who are we then? You know, if are you the only person that can sign your name? And the sort of the search for the authentic and sorting the fake from the real. It certainly seems like it was a theme in my childhood in relation to my dad and trying to make sense of who he was and who my parents were in relation to each other. And I think you sort of said at the beginning that. Who families actually are behind closed doors is so different to how they appear to the rest of the world. Absolutely. And even within that, you know, there are closed doors within homes, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And people are not who they seem to be, and none of us are who we purport to be. And I do think it's a sort of interesting area.
There are times in your pursuit of autographs where I have to say your morality is a little gray and cloudy. As a youngster, you wrote some outrageous lies in your letters in pursuit of autographs. And even as an older person, there's one time when you kind of got excited about Salman Rushdie having a price on his head. Can you talk about how maybe the acquisitiveness affected your morality?
Yeah, I mean, I think it took me a long time to realize that famous people were real. Actual people, and I think I just felt like they were fair game, you know, like I could do whatever it takes to get that autograph off them.
Yeah.
And also, it wasn't costing them anything, so, you know, so why can't they just give me, if they were withholding it, why are they withholding it? I should be able to have it. So, yeah.
What kind of lies did you tell?
Well, I would always underestimate my age. So when I was 13, I would write letters saying I was 9. And when I was 15, I was still 9, I think, you know. And figuring out sort of how to guilt trip people. And, I mean, I'd do things like Paul McCartney would never send me an autograph. So I figured I'll send him a Christmas card and enclose a blank one. So I've given him something, you know. Please, could you sign the blank one and send it back? And he did, and a few people did that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, made up a few lies about broken legs and things, I'm sure.
Thanks to Lee Randall and to Adam Andrusia. Two Hitlers and a Marilyn is available in audio commercially, read by the author.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Stuart Kelly is a Scottish critic and author. He is the literary editor of The Scotsman, and his works include The Book of Lost Books, an incomplete history of all the great books you'll never read, an account of books destroyed, misplaced, never finished, or never even began, from ancient Greek and Arabic masters through Shakespeare, Dante, Hemingway, right up to the present day. So before I asked him for the books of his life, I asked him for the lost book of his life.
That's quite a difficult question about which lost book I would want back. I suppose there's some obvious choices. Homer did a comedy epic called The Margites, which it would be astonishing to see what Homer's comedy was like. Mm. I don't know if it would pass all the politically correct takes nowadays. of course, a Shakespeare. But Cardenio is quite a late play. And the late plays, you know, after the Tempest, if you're looking at The Two Noble Kinsmen or some of the later ones there, they're not the vintage work. So there's also by Shakespeare, there's Love's Labour's One, which we don't know anything about. In fact, it might be one of the other plays. So, you know, obviously you'd want Shakespeare and you'd want Homer. But I don't know. I think, in a way, I prefer the books that are lost because they're always going to be perfect. And the last thing you want is to get something like, let's say, Sylvia Plath's second novel, Double Exposure, and realise that it just wasn't all that good.
So, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I think I've always been in love with reading, but there was a series of Ladybird books which were in rhyming quatrains that apparently I was obsessed with, and I would demand having First Day of the Holidays or Squirrel Nutkin's Adventure again and again and again. But the most important thing for me in some ways was it told you all the other books. It's a bit like the Mr. Men books, that you could see on the back of them all the other ones. And I think that's what induced my bibliomania, thinking, I have to have all of these.
This is a tale about a tale. A tale that belonged to a little red squirrel, and his name was Nutkin. He had a brother called Twinkleberry, and a great many cousins. They lived in a wood at the edge of a lake. In the middle of the lake, there is an island covered with trees and nut bushes, and amongst those trees stands a hollow oak tree, which is the house of an owl who is called Old Brown. One autumn, when the nuts were ripe and the leaves on the hazel bushes were golden and green, Nutkin and Twinkleberry and all the other little squirrels came out of the wood and down to the edge of the lake. They made little rafts out of twigs, and they paddled away over the water to Owl Island to gather nuts. Each squirrel had a little sack and a large oar, and spread out his tail for a sail.
The Adventure of Squirrel Nutkin is available from RNIB Talking Books in The Complete Beatrix Potter, narrated by Diana Bishop. And there are many Ladybird First Favourite Tales available from RNIB.
And is there a book that you go back to again and again on a rainy day?
I go back to the work of G.K. Chesterton quite frequently. I think he was one of the most beautiful essayists that we had. I know that some people have got some concerns about his politics now, but this was the man that said there are two enemies to humanity, Hitler and the Emperor of Japan. And the fact that he was such a wit, such a wag, and was just generally so funny. And something like The Man Who Was Thursday is, I can go back to every time, I still don't understand that book.
The suburb of Saffron Park lay on the sunset side of London, as red and ragged as a cloud of sunset. It was built of a bright brick throughout. Its skyline was fantastic, and even its ground plan was wild. It had been the outburst of a speculative builder, faintly tinged with art, who called its architecture sometimes Elizabethan and sometimes Queen Anne, apparently under the impression that the two sovereigns were identical. It was described with some justice as an artistic colony, though it never in any definable way produced any art. But although its pretensions to be an intellectual centre were a little vague, its pretensions to be a pleasant place were quite indisputable. The stranger who looked for the first time at the quaint red houses could only think how very oddly shaped the people must be who could fit into them. Nor, when he met the people, was he disappointed in this respect. The place was not only pleasant, but perfect. As if once he could regard it not as a deception, but rather as a dream.
The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as narrated by Toby Longworth. It's one of many Chesterton books available from RNIB, along with three different biographies. And something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
There's a book by a chap called Dennis Duncan called Index, A History of the... And you might think it sounds like the most boring topic in the world, but the whole way in which he shows how there are aspects of books which we are so accustomed to, we no longer actually look at. So when was the first page number on a book? Mm. How do we sort the information in a book? It's a really great work in terms of the human side of reading. I mean, all of us sometimes will use the index rather than the book. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll be looking for a particular thing that we want to know about. And it has the funniest index I've ever read in a book. He's done an exceptional job, and his indexer has done an exceptional job. So, you know, Index, A History of the... I even love the title to pieces.
It is hard to imagine working with books, writing an essay, a lecture, a report, a sermon, without the ability to find what you're looking for quickly and easily, without, that is, the convenience of a good index. This convenience, of course, is not confined to people who write for a living. It spills over into other disciplines, into everyday life, and some of the earliest indexes appear in legal statutes, medical texts, recipe books. The humble back-of-book index is one of those inventions that are so successful, so integrated into our daily practices, that they can often become invisible. But like any piece of technology, the index has its history, one that, for nearly 800 years, was intimately entwined with a particular form of the book, the codex. The sheaf of pages, folded and bound together at the spine. Now, however, it has entered the digital era as the key technology underpinning our online reading. The very first web page, after all, was a subject index. As for the search engine, the port of embarkation for so much of our internet navigation, Google engineer Matt Cutts explains that the first thing to understand is that when you do a Google search, you aren't actually searching the web, you're searching Google's index of the web. Today, the index organizes our lives, and this book will chart its curious path from the monasteries and universities of Europe in the 13th century to the glass and steel HQs of Silicon Valley in the 21st.
Index, A History of the... by Dennis Duncan is available in audio commercially, as narrated by Neil Gardner. And Stuart Kelly, thank you so much. Thanks for listening to this online, as that's where the broadcast version of the show stopped. But I also recorded the books of Graham McRae Burnett's life. It was played out on RNIB Connect Radio's Daily Connect show, but I'll also add it on here as a little online bonus. It's coming up after this Booker announcement from Red.
The Booker Prize is the UK's most prestigious literary award. And, as usual, Read On has been on hand to bring you all the latest news, reviews and interviews with this year's six shortlisted authors. The winner was announced at a ceremony in London on Wednesday night. And I'm delighted to tell you that Damon Galgut has won the 2021 Booker Prize for his novel The Promise. Thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation, it and all the books on the shortlist are available from the RNIB Library. And you can hear interviews with all the shortlisted authors by downloading Read On episodes 242 and 243 from your favourite podcast provider.
Graham McRae Burnett is a highly acclaimed Scottish author. His first novel earned him the Scottish Book Trust New Writer Award in 2013. And his second novel, His Bloody Project, was shortlisted for the 2016 Booker Prize. I met him at the Wigtown Book Festival to discuss his fourth novel, Case Study. And while there, he told me the books of his life.
Graham, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There was a wonderful book. It was in my grandmother's house. It was called Mr. Papengay and the Little Round House. And it concerned a little boy who goes to post a letter, but then he finds himself inside the pillar box with this weird community of people. And it's a sort of real, it's actually totally Kafkaesque. It's like Kafka for kids. And I was totally, every time I went to my granny's house, I returned to this book and just started rereading it again. It's really magical.
Quickly, he turned his head back again and looked at the friendly pillar box. And then he gave a funny little gasp and all at once stood still and stared. A light was shining through the slit in the round red pillar box. Robin took a few slow steps forward and then stopped again and stared. The pillar box was still round and red, but it was no longer ordinary looking. Half a dozen little windows with lace curtains had appeared in its side, and low down by the pavement he could see a little front door with a knocker and a letterbox and a bell. The pillar box was no longer a pillar box. It was a little round house.
Mr. Papingay and the Little Round House, or as I found a copy of it simply titled Little Round House by Marion St. John Webb, is available commercially, read by Margaret Wooster. Although, like me, you may have to search for a while.
And is there a book that on a rainy day like today you go back to again and again?
The book I return to most is Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, simply because I've become familiar with it. I love the world of the book. And although it's out from the outside, it might seem like a big, heavy Russian classic, it's tremendously compelling. And the characters are, you know, so full of life, and the settings are so full of life. So that's a book I can go and I'm in the world of the book.
July, in exceptional heat. Towards evening, a young man left the garret he was renting in Stoliani Lane, stepped outside, and slowly, as if in two minds, set off towards Kukushkin Bridge. He successfully avoided meeting his landlady on the stairs. His garret was right beneath the eaves of a tall, five-story building and resembled a cupboard more than it did a room. His landlady, a tenant herself, who also provided him with dinner and a maid, occupied separate rooms on the floor below, and every time he went down he had no choice but to pass her kitchen, the door of which was nearly always wide open. And every time he passed it, the young man experienced a sickening, craven sensation that made him wince with shame. He owed his landlady a small fortune, and he was scared of meeting her.
There are two versions of Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky in the RNIB library. One read by Corbett Woodall that is 23 hours and 50 minutes, and the one we've just played narrated by Don Warrington, which comes in at 25 hours and 3 minutes.
And is there something contemporary you'd like to recommend?
Reasonably contemporary. I really enjoyed Deborah Orr's memoir, Motherwell. I'm from Kilmarnock, a little bit younger than Deborah Orr was. But I found her writing about growing up in the 70s in a town a bit like mine just super, super familiar and very enjoyable, very compelling and quite moving.
We were wary of the Bureau, my brother and I, even though it was ours now and we could do what we liked with it. There was no one to stop us anymore. No mum, no dad, no rules. Yet so much of the Bureau had been a forbidden zone for such a long time. The administrative heart of our family home at number 18 Clyde Terrace Muir House, Motherwell ML12NG. My parents had bought the Bureau when they first got married and set up home on Empress Avenue in Romford, Essex at the start of the 1960s. It had made the journey with them up to Thistle Street, Motherwell, Lanarkshire, less than a year later. That was where we lived when I was born. Four more years, and it had travelled another couple of miles to Shields Drive, Muirhouse, Motherwell, and the birth of my younger brother David. Another 6 years, and another few hundred yards, and the Bureau, along with its complete and perfect nuclear family, had reached Clyde Terrace, where it stayed for almost 5 decades, before it headed back the way it had come, and moved in with me in London.
Motherwell, A Girlhood by Deborah Orr is narrated by Gabriel Quigley and is available commercially. And Graham McRae-Burnett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Always good to talk to you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you once again to everyone at the Wigtown Book Festival. Red will be back next week. If you want to find us on Twitter, Red is at Redsell, R-E-D-S-Z-E-L-L, and I am at Talking_Books. Until next week, remember to read on.